go? Do we not raise the blade, trim the rot? Are you ready to be shot? Do we want a war? Anybody listening? Haven't we learned anything? What's the point of killing when it hasn't worked before? Before the final culture clash, before this fragile piece is smashed, before we all do something rash, back it up. Situation simmer, nothing to consider. Implications of a war, nobody will win. Fundamental chaos, fighting for the right to use God's name and everything related to the cause. Everybody, everybody breathe. Everybody, everybody believe. Before we step right off the edge, before we are at war in Z, before we start to count the dead, back it up.
Everybody breathes, everybody believes.
We elect the ones who choose, how many they're prepared to lose. Put in power, supposedly, to rescue us from death's decree.
Everybody breathes, everybody believes.
Theological debate collapses into racial hate. Faith has made us dumb and blind to the future of mankind. We all breathe, we all bleed, we all share the basic needs. Draft by color, place of birth, you're on this team, so pray it works. Into racial hate. Faith has made us dumb and blind to the future of mankind.
Everybody breathes.
Yes, stop.
Everybody
what your country can do for you.
Everybody breathes.
Yes, what you can do for your country.
Watch the camera on the world, keeping you and me involved, being fed what to believe, with no control of what we see.
Everybody breathes, everybody, everybody breathes, everybody, everybody breathes, everybody.
Welcome and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out in Studio A with Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Seymour Hirst. He is interviewed by Steve Scherr. The Pulitzer Prize winning journalist is responsible for exposing many of the biggest stories in the 20th century, and he's still hard at work. Hirsch alleges that senior officials were waging a crusade overseas protecting Christianity from the Muslims. And then after that, we have a couple stories about that thing that nobody wants to talk about, the natural gas business. The natural gas business is booming, sometimes with deadly results. Host Bruce Gellerman sniffs out the cracks in the nearly 2 million miles of pipes that run under our city. And then after that, he goes on to a story about the third of a million miles of natural gas transmission pipelines in the U.S. Sometimes they rupture, devastating homes and lives. Bruce Gellerman speaks with investigative blogger Frank Gallagher, editor of naturalgaswatch.org, about the hazards of this vast system.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hirsch is responsible for exposing some of the biggest stories of the last 50 years. He's still at work. He was in Seattle last night talking about foreign policy. So I thought I would just start asking foreign policy questions of you if I can.
Why don't we just get rid of the Air Force and 10 of the carriers and a lot of the Army, and put a few $100 billion back into the cities. And just listening to the councilman member speak, you know, it's all about money.
Now, you have a lot of contacts in the military. Do you know any of them that would support that?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of guys. There's a lot of guys. I wouldn't say necessarily in the military, in the military world, civilians who work totally for the military, do budget stuff. There are a lot of people who realize that we have a lot of anachronisms. And for example, Air Force. We're talking about a world now that in which, you know, who are we going to bomb? I mean, it's the Cold War is over. We're dealing with, a different kind of warfare. In which major B-52 bombs don't have much of an impact. Our nuclear arsenal doesn't have much of an impact. It's never going to happen.
I mean, why do the powers hold such strength against making that happen? If there are people in quasi-leadership positions that do see the idea for restructuring the military. I know it's all money, but what keeps them so strong and entrenched? Who knows?
What makes us go from one dumb war in Vietnam, in which we're fighting in a culture we don't understand, against a society that against people we don't see, irregulars, that we don't see set pieces. We have a disaster in Vietnam. We go from there to a disaster in Iraq. We go from there to a disaster in Afghanistan. We've just sent 100 men into Uganda. 100 special forces just a few days ago.
Does that make you nervous, by the way?
Oh, my God, yes.
He has the support of Congress. It resolved, let's get the Lord's Resistance Army and do something about them, three or four months ago? Didn't Congress make a resolution?
Oh, Congress, come on. Give me a break.
It's bipartisan support.
Just go read Black Hawk Down and start thinking Mogadishu. It'll probably be fine. But 100 guys allegedly there to help train the forces. We're going after this madman running around in that area. But I don't know if that's our problem necessarily. We're not doing so well in the wars we're in now. I don't know why we want to go to another one. And Congress, as far as I'm concerned, the great story of our time is how fragile our Constitution is. I was talking about this last night at the UW in Tacoma. Here we have 9/11 come in, and after that, 8 or 9 neocons basically hijack the American government. Congress goes down. The American press goes down. We become cheerleaders for wars instead of being objective about it. And it just shows me how easy it was to just turn this into, at least under Bush Cheney, into something other than a functioning, vibrant democracy. It's not so great now even. Also under Obama, I think.
Seymour Hersh is a Pulitzer Prize winner. His books include The Price of Power, Kissinger in the Nixon White House, The Dark Side of Camelot, and most recently Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. Well, actually, let me go to Abu Ghraib for a minute, and then we'll wander our way back up, since you say it's not so good right now. Were there, in the people you've talked to, were there lessons from Abu Ghraib that have been learned that translated into more secrecy?
Sure. Of course, it always happens that way.
It always happens that way.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things you learn, in Vietnam, we had a pretty vibrant press. About my My Lai stuff and stuff like that. And there was a lot of critical reporting about the war. So when the Gulf War begins in 2001, we embed reporters. We bring in the anchormen, and they're with the troops. And yes, they see terrible things. Look, our kids are really nice kids, the American soldiers. Americans generally are very nice people. We're cheerful. We're good tippers. We spend money. We're fun to be with. People around the world still make a differentiation, I think, to a much lesser degree than they did 10 years ago, between the government and the people of America. They make a distinction. And people still are willing to talk to us as individuals. I mean, that's been my experience. And the answer is that when you embed reporters, they like the kids they're traveling with. They see things right away. I mean, they've all written books and written articles and talked about it. Seeing a guy's manning a checkpoint and a car coming at him, and they start yelling in English, "Stop! Slow down!" And of course, nobody understands what they say in the air world. They shrug, and then they open up and kill a bunch of women and children, wipe out a family, and they don't report it because they're embedded. There and so that was a very wise thing that the Cheney Bush government did.
But does the secrecy go further? For example, is the Obama administration using secret prisons and following some of the actions that we saw? Maybe not as much as egregious as Abu Ghraib, but following some of the actions we found reported in Abu Ghraib.
Well, in terms of, you know, taking photographs of men pretending to masturbate, no. I mean, I think we learned something from that. But there's no question there's still secret prisons. There's no question there's still many operations not briefed to Congress.
Torture?
Sure. Of course.
By Americans. What?
War is the nature of war. You're in Afghanistan. You're at best, it's a totally demoralized fighting force. NATO's gone to seed. NATO wants out. Most of the NATO countries don't want to contribute. We're hanging on by our fingernails with NATO. That's just a figment. We're doing most of the muscling. There are some foreign, you know, European generals running around, but very few troops. We're doing most of the stuff. It's always called NATO missions, but it's our special operations force usually when they say NATO mission. And so the kids are, most of the grunts, the army guys, they're patrolling. They're patrolling in an area that is controlled at night, by and large, in some cases, by Taliban or Taliban supporters. Our guys don't know the language. We know that they can go. We can go out in day, but at night we come back and they control the night, just like in Vietnam. The guys are exposed to bombs, landmines, bouncing Bettys that go, yes, at the legs, but also at the genitals. And this is a huge, big, frightening problem that everybody's manhood is on the line. And inevitably, you build up a hatred. One of the things about the Army, I wasn't in combat, but I was in the Army. One of the things is it's all about your buddies. It's not about the flag. A buddy gets hurt. You want payback. You start – abuses are so inevitable in that situation. The front page of today's Olympian here in Washington has actually amazingly good story about a terrible murder that took place in Afghanistan by somebody who was doing the led by a sergeant, allegedly, who was doing the same sort of stuff in Iraq. Of course these go on. Of course, torture. I don't know what torture means. There's torture, you know, the President of the United States said after
people in cells with prisoners putting wet burlap sacks over their heads instead of reading them their rights and treating them with some dignity according to the Geneva Convention.
But torture suggests that you're doing it to get something, let's say information. Often what happens, it's mere gamesmanship. You're just doing it. You want to collect fingers or eyeballs or whatever. It's happening. Of course it happens. It happens in all wars. It's happening in this war.
Seymour Hersh is our guest. We'll take a break and come back and continue to talk cheerfully about what's happening in the world. I want to go to Iran, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and then talk about the drone wars, if we can, and cyber wars. Seymour Hersh is our guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. You were in where were you? Dubai. What town were you in? Now, where you made the speech about the military?
It wasn't in a speech. It was a question.
A question.
And just like now, I sometimes dread what I say because everybody's always surprised to hear things they don't want to hear.
Yeah. All right. Well, senior officials were waging a crusade overseas. You used that word specifically.
The president, if you remember, used it very early after 9/11, and he meant it. What he meant was, I've been doing a book for the last few years on Cheney Bush that spilled over into this administration because some of the ideas obviously did, continuing the war in Afghanistan, et cetera, and also the prison complex, a lot of stuff, not closing Guantanamo. All these things were ideas that perpetuated the previous administration. This is nothing new to everybody. There is a notion that Bush Cheney had that after 9/11, you know, they could have treated what happened, the terrible event that happened, the Twin Towers and all that, as a criminal act. We saw in India when in Mumbai, former Bombay, we used to call it, when a train, there was a terrible terrorist act in a train station. 700 people or something like that died. The Indians treated it as a criminal activity. In Spain, also in the last 4 or 5 years, there was a terrible, remember they bombed the train station.
Yeah.
And, I think
yeah.
300 casualties. Percentage-wise, huge too, given the population. They treated it as a criminal case. In the case of 9/11, we went to the global war on terror. And inside the White House, it was seen as we against the Muslims. I'm not exaggerating. As basically a war. They wanted what we have. They were jealous of what we have. You remember that language.
Yes.
They're only coming because they want what we have.
They tempered it by saying, oh, it's just the jihadis. It's not all. We're not at a war with all of Islam.
But the fact of the matter is we basically declared that anybody who supported terrorism and whatever that meant would be considered a terrorist. And, you know, you have very complicated relationships between Sunni fundamentalists and in around the world, places like Pakistan. It's complicated. And so that sort of blanket stuff. And when he said crusade, he was, you know, I can't tell you he knew about the monk, you know, all those various institutions in the crusade, the crusaders, and the various religious sects that were fighting in the 13th and 12th century that were protecting the the pilgrims, making the crusades. We would our forces. There were the various various orders, religious orders that were protecting them. And a lot of that idea is still very dominant in some of our special forces units. The notion that this is their internal medals, their internal readings have to do often with the Crusades. And there's a very strong, incredibly strong religious element among some of the more elite special forces units. Absolutely.
Did you mean literally Opus Dei, Knights of Malta, membership by McChrystal and others, or did you mean it more figuratively?
I didn't mean it. I was answering a question. And some members, Opus Dei obviously is not a militaristic group. It's a religious order of sort of a lot of mysticism. When I was a kid reporting AP, I wrote a long series about Opus Dei. That was imprecise. I should have been much more careful and said there were various that General McChrystal, who then was leading the Joint Special Operations Command, the guy who got in trouble with a Rolling Stone article. By bad-mouthing the president and I guess who? Biden.
Biden, yeah. Yes. In front of a reporter, right?
Yeah. Not a smart thing to do. But most reporters, I think it's fair to say, are more on the team than that. This fellow was named Hastings. I don't know him. But most reporters, I assure you, have heard this kind of talk before. The beat with guys, and they understand. You know, that's the rule is you don't write these things because then you don't get the access. It's all about access. You have to have the access. If you work for the New York Times, where I did for many years, it was always painful because access is so important. So you tend to make sure you have access, and that means sometimes you're not always doing what you should. I don't know what, but anyway, the bottom line is I'm not going to back away from saying what I said, which is there's a very strong. Fervent religious streak in many of the special ops units, and they do see it in this black white. We're here. We're defending the. You know, we're the Crusaders defending the Pilgrims.
And it goes up the chain of command, and colors our foreign policy.
I think in the Bush White House, it certainly colored the initial response. You know, this general response that this is we have to go after. Bin Laden, we have to take down the Taliban, who didn't have, and to this day, nobody can quite explain what the national security threat to America is of the Afghan Taliban. And the answer is they're not interested in knocking down buildings. Most of them were very hostile to Bin Laden at the time he did the attack. And there had been long debates inside the Taliban. I'm not telling anything that isn't empirical. It's been written. Just recently, a new book by a British correspondent, Jonathan Steele, has written a very good book describing the hostility and worry about Bin Laden the Taliban had before 9/11. They knew he was going to get him in trouble. He was not they. He was not one of them. He was an Arab, and the Taliban were not. And he wasn't a Pashtun. He was an outsider. Anyway, yes, there's a strong religious fervor. I'm going to write about it in much more depth. But I've seen their medals. They are Crusader medals. UNICEF have medals.
Medals, right? You're talking about medals.
Well, they have little. They all give each other. UNICEF have medals in the military. And if you go meet somebody who is a general, you'll find many of them have a board in which they've listed, the 200 or 300 medals they have from the various units. Units, they all cast medals. to commemorate something. And sometimes people, the classic one would be John F. Kennedy, all the people that were involved in the deliberations about the missile crisis. All of those people got a memento from the president. So units, that notion of having mementos for serving in a unit or being involved in something special, I assure you the special forces guys that took down bin Laden have cast a medal about it. And the medals, I've seen medals in which literally the emblem is a crusader. You know, it's the Latin also comes from some of the scriptures of the 12th century. Hmm. There's no question. There's a connection. It doesn't mean every soldier's involved. And McChrystal's one of the nickname for McChrystal was the monk because he lived so ascetically. Others called him, by the way, not everybody loved him. Others called him dear leader after our friend in North Korea. So, but there you are.
So, Seymour Hersh, the last big story you wrote was about how close Iran was to a nuclear weapon and whether the Obama administration was overstating their nuclear weapon capabilities. Where are we today on that?
Oh, well, we're now being driven half crazy by briefings from the White House about the danger. They can't decide which way to do it, how to play it. A few days ago, it was Iran is closer. The Israelis have been saying for 20 years that Iran is anywhere from 6 to 12 months from a bomb. And what I did was a piece last summer in The New Yorker. I don't know when it was.
But, June 6th.
It was summer. Okay. Saying that there have been two national intelligence estimates, which are the holy grail of the American intelligence community. The first one was signed by 16 agencies. There's been a proliferation of agencies since. The second one was 18 people signed it. 18 heads of various intelligence agencies all agreed that Iran, whatever interest Iran had in building a bomb as opposed to enriching, they are enriching, and they are a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and they've signed the nonproliferation treaties, they're signatories of that, and everything that we know they have is under camera, controlled by the nuclear watchdog. It's a UN watchdog, IAEA, that's based in Vienna. They have cameras all over the place monitoring it. There's no question. Nobody's suggesting that we've been able to find any evidence of any enrichment facilities we don't know about. There's absolutely no evidence at all we've been able to find, not only through the IAEA, but I've been writing. I spent years in The New Yorker in from 05 to 08 writing ad nauseum. I mean, boring everybody to death by writing again and again. Our special forces were inside Iran. We sent teams in there. We were working with dissidents. There's Haziri, there's Kurdish opposition, there's Jandela, this crazy Sunni group we gave money to that would spy for us. We were trying to find, like in the movie Bananas, you know, in Bananas there's a scene where there's an underground robot factory. The robots are making facilities. Cheney was convinced somewhere there was an underground place where they were making a bomb. Making a bomb and producing uranium are really different animals. To make a bomb, you have to take the most toxic gas you can imagine, 95% enriched pure uranium, U-25. You have to take this UF-6 gas, convert it into a metal. We're talking about in a shielded facility with men doing robotics. You can't go near it. You have to work through advanced robotics. You're touching buttons, and there's a lead wall between you and what you're seeing with glass. I don't know. It's pretty dangerous. And it's also billions of dollars, hundreds of millions to build a facility like that. You have to convert it into a metal and then mold it into a core. I mean, there's no evidence any of this exists. All that did happen, according to the 03 and the let's see, two estimates, 06 and one earlier this year, and by the National Intelligence Estimates, about which I learned more than I should have. What they said was the only time Iran thought seriously about getting into the weapons business was after their 8-year war with Iraq. And people in America don't realize Iran and Iraq had this terrible war for 8 years in which we supported Iraq. We supported Saddam with a lot of intelligence. You know, we didn't like the mullahs for kicking out our man, the Shah, and taking our hostages, if you remember, in 79, what cost Carter the election, that whole issue. In any case, after that war ended, Iraq was still publicly talking about a bomb. Iran did get nervous, and they did some studies. Boom. The NIE said that after we went into Baghdad and wiped and took down Baghdad in 3 weeks, what Iran couldn't do in 8 years, they stopped. That was it. They'd done some studies. They stopped worrying about it because Baghdad was gone. That's the extent to which of it.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org. Or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
So many things going on in the world. Babies dying, mothers crying. How much oil is one human life worth? And what happened to peace on earth? We believe everything that they tell us. They're gonna kill us, so we gotta kill them first. I remember a commandment, thou shalt not kill. How much is that soldier's life worth? And what happened to peace on earth? And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. And how much is a liar's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth? I guess it's just due unto others before they can do it to you. Let's just kill them all and let God sort them out. Is this what God wants us to do? You won't hear this song on the radio, probably. Not on your local TV. But if you're inclined and you ever have time, you can always hear it from me. And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth?
And now for something completely different.